Dear friends, we've come to the end of the book of Genesis. It's the end of the beginnings. Sounds strange, but nevertheless, Genesis means beginning. And the beginning of the whole plan of God, as it was purposed in Christ Jesus, as far as the human race is concerned, finds its beginning there. And if you look carefully enough, you'll also find the end. We commence then today with the book of Exodus. We call it the book of Exodus merely because of the fact that the translators of the Septuagint version chose to call it the Exodus. They called it the Exodus because of the fact that the chief event recorded therein is the Exodus. It will be the same with the book of Numbers because of the numbering of the children of Israel recorded there. But in the Hebrew scriptures, it is not so. The name of the book is Ve'alei Shemot, which means the generation, or these are the generations. After the first word with which the book of Exodus begins. Now, needless to say, perhaps, that we're fully satisfied in our own minds that the book of Exodus was written by the same man who wrote the book of Genesis. And we believe that there are evidences within the book itself which clearly reveal that. And in anticipation of our lesson, perhaps we would remind you that when it speaks of Moses being hidden in the basket in the Nile, there's not a word said about the religion. There isn't anything said about Amram, his father. The only thing that we read about Amram is that he was one who was Jochebed, his Moses, for a while. And his death is recorded. But that is all. And there are lots of things that are left out entirely because of the fact that he who wrote it did not glory in himself. And to find the substance of much that is said there, you have to go to the New Testament and Stephen and others, the Apostle Paul, bring the glory to Moses that belongs to Moses, which Moses would not take unto himself. So we see that he was a man of meekness, of humility, and the scribe undoubtedly that has recorded it said that he was the meekest man in all the earth. Now, before commencing with the book of Genesis, we would merely like to say that before beginning with the book of Exodus, we're going back for a little review of what precedes it in Genesis. And there we find, dear friends, that the children of Israel had been brought down into Egypt because of the fact that they had sinned against their brother. And it's interesting to note, dear friends, that the purpose of recording all of this history was not for Israel. It was for you and for me. Not that we might know the history of Israel, but so that we might take the lessons from the history of Israel which pertain to us. They were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages are come. And so we must look carefully, and we must not overlook. There is a tendency, of course, to treat them perhaps a little too lightly. Oh, yes, we appreciate them as types and shadows of better things to come, but we don't always make the proper application to ourselves personally. And we like to think in this connection of Joseph. He loved his brethren despite the fact that they had ill-treated him. And it was because of his intercession on their behalf that they were brought down into the land of Egypt, and it was he who nourished them and kept them alive so long as he lived. But we see then, dear friends, that despite the fact that all of this was so overwhelming in the life of Joseph to show his love. These things were not so appreciated nor understood by his brethren. They couldn't understand how there could be such disinterested love in Joseph. They couldn't understand how there wouldn't be in him that vindictiveness that sought righteousness and judgment for himself, like the blood of Abel crying out for justice. Well, dear friends, of course, as it is with an artist, he cannot put into a picture except what is in himself. And we cannot, dear friends, give out or understand in another that which we do not have in ourselves. We couldn't understand the mind of God if it were not for the fact that he gives us his own spirit by which we can understand it. We think we understand another man, but we merely judge the other man by the propensities in our own lives. In other words, we know what we would do under the circumstance, and consequently we judge them. And in judging them, we're judging ourselves, and that's just exactly what Jesus said. So, of course, Jesus came to his own, and they received him not. They couldn't imagine anybody so good as Jesus was. And dear friends, has it been any different through the age with the followers of Jesus? Those who preceded Jesus, of whom the testimony was, of them the world was unworthy. And I'll tell you what, dear friends, it should be true of the things too, that the world is unworthy of them. And so, dear friends, we cannot expect to be appreciated by the world. Jesus didn't expect that. But Jesus did expect to be appreciated by his brethren. And that was what tried Joseph so. That after his father died, that they should come to him in fear and say, well, your father Jacob told us to speak this way to you. I have great doubts that Jacob ever told the brethren to say that to Joseph. I feel that Jacob knew Joseph far too well. But from what we know about the brethren, we might be sure that they would dissemble. Well, at any rate, we know that despite the fact that they did not appreciate his love, his care, he did care for them until he died. And years went by, and it says that generation died, Joseph died, his brethren died. And then a new Pharaoh ascended to the throne. But why do you suppose that the Holy Scriptures bring this fact to our attention? Well, I think it is because of the fact that everything connected with this mundane life of ours is indelibly marked perishable. It can't stay. It won't last. It will pass away. But it is just this fact, dear friends, that should make us appreciate it the more. If you could be in the garden where there were flowers, perhaps tuberoses, and just be there all the time, you get to the point where, because of the peculiar nature that you have as a result of the fall, you'd wish that you could get away from it for a while and get a change. Well, the Father knows that we need the changes, and the Father only knows what changes to give us. And so sometimes he has us up on the mountaintops. And when we're in the valley below, dear friends, he sometimes has sent us or placed us there so that we might learn from the transitoriness of life itself to put a value upon those things that are imperishable. Thus we're admonished to seek first the kingdom of God and its righteousness, and that all else would be added unto us. Now we say, dear friends, that it is God who has purposed this checkered career, as it were. Joseph was a beloved of his father. He received a coat of many colors. He was hated because of it by his brethren. He was cast into a well. Did they hear his cries of anguish? Dear friends, no more than sometimes today, the cry of anguish is heard from the soul of a man. But dear friends, human nature hasn't changed. It's still the same, but it's human nature, dear friends. It should not be that way with the new nature. So the Apostle Paul says, we know no man according to the flesh. We know him according to the Spirit. And if we know him according to the Spirit, well, dear friends, then we can overlook the flesh. Well, we're speaking, dear friends, of Joseph again, cast into the well, brought up, sold as a slave. The hardships of this life we cannot fully appreciate until we find him again exalted a bit in the house of Potiphar. And then his experience with Potiphar's wife cast into prison. He reveals a dream to the butler and the baker, who soon forget. And he languishes away in prison some more. And finally he is exalted to the throne. But you see, dear friends, down, up, down, up. We say, dear friends, that we only appreciate the fragrance of the rose because we know it won't last. We know it will pass away. I stood by a rose bush bending low, with its lovely blossoms as white as snow, and I sighed as I looked at its perfect bloom and drank in its fragrance and rich perfume. For I said, it is fair, it cannot stay. It will pass away, it will pass away. I looked on a dull November sky and heard the bleak wind moan and sigh. Never a blossom grew at my feet. The birds had flown and the sad rain beat. But I said, though the hour is dull and gray, it will pass away. It will pass away. I looked on a face that was fair with youth, bright with promise, and sweet with truth. Cloudless the azure, the sun was up, spilling its light like an o'erfilled cup. Smile on, I said, while lingers night. It will pass away. It will pass away. I looked on a heart bowed down with woe, bent with sorrow, as boughs with stone. But I said there was never a mighty grief that yet found comfort and sweet relief. The snow will melt in the sun someday. It will pass away. It will pass away. The one great ruler of all expanse, give us this law of recompense, that ever must pleasure pay tax to pain, and pain restore to hope again, and nothing is lost, however we say it has passed away. It has passed away. And so, dear friends, even though the things that we value most highly, the things that we appreciate most must pass away, so likewise the experiences, the sadnesses, the sorrows, they too pass away. Thus you see there is a compensation there, and God compensates. And remember the words of Moses who said, Lord, so teach us to number our days that we may apply our hearts unto wisdom. He says, remember us according to the days wherein thou hast afflicted us. That's divine philosophy, dear friends. And it's something that you and I should long since have made our own. We should be able to appreciate the fact that nothing stays, nothing lasts. Only one life. will soon be past. Only what's done for Jesus will last. And thus we find then, dear friends, that after Joseph had died, and that generation died, and they still lived in the land of Egypt. But a new Pharaoh came to the throne who knew not Joseph. And you say, did God know about it? Weren't these the children of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob? How is it that he has neglected them so? Didn't he give them the covenant? Weren't they to be blessed because of Abraham, their father, and his faith? Oh, yes, indeed. But God doesn't promise us beds of roses. He knows that the things that we need oftentimes are the things that we do not want. But the things that we want are often the things that we do not need. But God, in his wisdom, gives us the things that we need. Brother Russell says, the wealth laboriously gathered and husbanded with much care may vanish in an hour. The fame so dearly won may be changed to censure at the caprice of a fickle public sentiment. It's not only the public sentiment that is fickle, dear friends. We're just as fickle. We're just as changeable. We have our moods, you know. We get into places sometimes. Well, I'd rather not have anybody talk to me because I'm on edge. Oh, you never like that. So much the better. The social distinction which once bade you to the uppermost seat may by and by relegate you to the lowest seat as one despised and forsaken. Houses and lands may disappear under the sheriff's hammer. Friends long trusted may suddenly turn the cold shoulder and prove untrue or even treacherous. The home you love must sooner or later break up. The family will be scattered, or death will invade it. Or even the love that glowed on the home altar may flicker and become uncertain or extinct. So the high hopes of earthly life, centered in the earthly treasures, may in a few short years turn to ashes. How many have found it so? The moth of wear and the rust of time corrupt the fair earthly blessings, and thieves break through and steal the treasures of our possessions and our hearts, and dissolution and gloom are the painful results. But it is not so with those whose treasure is laid up in the heavens. So you see, dear friends, in order to make us appreciate the things which are lasting, the Heavenly Father has to put things in our way that make us dissatisfied with the things of the earth. Have you had that experience? Well, if you haven't had it, maybe it's still to come. But you're going to have it. If you're a child of God, you must have it. And so, with Israel in the land of Egypt and Joseph dying, now they come under pressure. There's a fire. There's heat. But you know what heat does, dear friends? It just welds things together. You take two pieces of metal, and you lay them side by side and subject both of them to the same heat, and they will be knit together. They'll be welded together. That's what God was doing. Here was to be a nation that was to be one nation. They might have been assimilated, but they've never been assimilated by any people. They're still separate and independent. But they are one people, even as their God, the God of Israel, is one God. So, of course, they were subjected to the heat of these experiences in Egypt, to weld them together as a people, to make them dissatisfied with the land of Egypt, to awaken in them a desire for the promise that had been made. And dear friends, you don't need to take my word for it. Joshua says so too, that when they were down in Egypt, they forgot the God of their fathers, and they began to worship the idols, the gods of Egypt. Joshua says that before they enter into the promised land. He says, put away those gods that your fathers and you worshipped in the land of Egypt. So you see, here is something that God applies to knit them together as one and to reawaken in them the glorious hope which came with the precious promises which were made to Abraham before, and Isaac, and reiterated to Jacob. Well, now you'll notice then, dear friends, that this Pharaoh, he began to see that the children of Israel were getting quite numerous. And he was a bit fearful that in their numbers there might be that which would put an end to his own empire. You see, the pharaohs that ruled, or particularly the pharaoh that ruled at the time when Joseph was the prime minister of Egypt, he was undoubtedly one of the Hyksos, one of the shepherd kings that came down into the land of Egypt, subjugated the people, and probably just before the time of our lesson, there must have been a rebellion or an insurrection, and the former dynasty was overthrown, and Ramesses I comes to the throne of Egypt. He cared nothing about Joseph nor those people, and so he figured the best thing to do is to tire them out and weaken them so much that they'll die out. And so what did he do? Well, he increased their work. He drafted them and put them under taskmasters. I think that's probably the first draft ever recorded. It doesn't say it was conscription, but really it was. These Israelites were taken from the land of Goshen, where they were shepherds, and brought into the land of Egypt, and subjected to hardship there. And there it was that they had to build treasure cities for Pharaoh. Well, now, dear friends, there were two of these treasure cities that we read about. In the 11th verse of the first chapter, therefore, they did set over them taskmasters to afflict them with their burden, and they built for Pharaoh treasure cities, Pithom and Raamses. Now, dear friends, we do know this, that this Pharaoh was not a figure of Jehovah God like the Pharaoh that ruled during Joseph's reign. This Pharaoh, see, you've got to watch the signposts. This Pharaoh certainly was a figure of Satan. And the Israelites represent the church of God all the way down through the age. And as Pharaoh wanted to put an end to the increasing power which would mark the end of his administration, so Satan has, of course, been busy with the saints of God. And the very first thing that he got them to do after the apostles fell asleep was to build two great treasure cities, Pithom and Raamses. And by this I mean, dear friends, Catholicism and Protestantism. The saints of God were busy building these great edifices. I say spiritual Israel. They were so busy building these edifices that they had no time to think of God or the precious promises. Great cathedrals, Gothic structures. You look at the pictures of these ancient churches throughout the world, you see some of the workmanship of the spiritual Israelites. Now, when I use the term spiritual Israelites, I don't refer merely to those who are the saints, but I'm talking about what is known as the antitypical Israel of God, not the fleshly Israel. And we know that this antitypical Israel, though we use it in a figurative sense, is just as fleshly as was the Israel of old. And so they built these great treasure cities. But dear friends, don't think that's where it ended. He's tackled you. He's tackled me. He has you building a Python. He has you building a Ramses. What do you mean, Brother Fry? Well, that you'll have to judge for yourself. I can only make the suggestion. Perhaps it's an ambition to be something, the best of what you are. It may be a home. It may be an automobile. It may be a radio. It may be anything, dear friends, that he busies you with in order to accomplish or to gain your objective, which is contrary to the spirit of your God. This is the thing where you have to look in and see. This is the place where I must leave you. Because if I were to point out in you, I would merely be pointing out what is in myself, wouldn't I? Of course. So it's a matter that each and one of us individually must examine himself to find out how busily we are engaged building up treasure cities, worldly things, earthly things, which have the tendency to detract us, our time, our money, our talent, our everything from the service of our God, which interfere, of course, with our covenant relationship. So you see, dear friends, that what he did way back there was merely a picture. What he's still doing with the Israel of God, building great treasure cities. But you know, despite this fact, the real saints continued on the increase. I mean the real saints. Among the antitypical Israel of God, there were real saints. And they increased. And of course, Satan never did like that. No more than did Pharaoh of old. And so he thought the next best thing to do was to just stop this flow of life at its source. Well, he couldn't keep the people from coming together. But he could instruct the midwives to take such action as when a male child came into the world that it would immediately be destroyed. And so he speaks to the midwives, Shiphrah and Puah, and he said, when you do the office of the midwife to the Hebrew women and see them upon the stools, if it be a son, then ye shall kill him. But if he be a daughter, then she shall live. There's a lot more than the male and female in this. I'd like to discuss it, but of course we won't have the time to discuss that at this particular moment. However, you'll notice the word stools occurs in here. It only occurs twice in the Hebrew scriptures. In the other instance, it is translated the potter's wheel. Seems strange. Surely it doesn't have reference here to a potter's wheel. But both of them were made of stone, and so undoubtedly some little sort of a contraption, a stone bathtub or whatever it was, that was used for bathing the child at its birth. You see, it would be possible for a midwife, as soon as she discovered the sex of the child, if it was to stick its head under the water and keep it there and kill it off in that way. That was his object, you see. Well, now, dear friends, what is the significance of that? We can only give you a suggestion. We're not trying to be wise above that which is written. We're only trying to counsel, dear friends, and point our finger in the direction of what may be the truth. If it isn't, why, just forget it. We do know this, dear friends, that our own existence as spiritual Israelites is largely contingent upon those who were Israelites before us. What I mean by that, those who were in the truth, by the lives that they have lived, have inspired life in us so that we, in turn, didn't take their places nor supplant them, but as they died off, a new living generation was here to take the place of those who'd gone on before. And so it is, dear friends, that in the divine providences there always have been saints of God who in their living inspired those who were in the future begotten of the same spirit with which they had been begotten. The names of these two midwives, who were undoubtedly in charge of all of the midwives of the Hebrew women, Shiphrah means beautiful, and Puah, the means sort of a crimson, sort of a blushing tenderness, a humility, a reticence. And dear friends, if there is anything about the Holy Spirit which makes possible your taking life, it is the fact of its beauty and its reticence. If you find it in a saint of God, a beautiful character, and that reticence that keeps itself back, does not cast itself forward, is not aggressive, is not egotistic nor egoistic, if you understand. So we say then, dear friends, that in the power of the saints who manifest this grace of beauty of character and a reticence, that if that had not been present, perhaps you would not be here today. Suppose everyone that had come into the truth in the generation that lived before you was self-centered and didn't care about you, didn't care about living a living testimony. They would have died themselves, and with themselves would end the generation, wouldn't it? And so in this picture, of course it's a little involved, I know, dear friend, but most things of the Spirit are. And if we sink ourselves deep into it, we'll see how it is that the life that you and I now live is in itself that which will inspire others who may be called upon after us. I don't know how long the church will be here. I don't know how long the door will be open. I do not know when spirit begetting will cease. But I don't believe that it has yet. But when it does cease, well, then of course that's the end. But until that time, one generation inspires the next with life. But the life which is passed on, dear friend, is a life that traces itself back to God and the begettal of the Holy Spirit by Jesus at the Jordan, the passing down of it to the church at Pentecost. So the life of those Israelites that were in Egypt traces itself back to faithful Abraham, doesn't it? Of course it does. And without Abraham, they would not have been. So without God, we could not be. But you see, dear friends, there were always faithful witnesses of God. And because of this, that God always had a witness, a faithful witness in this earth, you and I are privileged to be among the antitypical Israel of God. We've not been exterminated. That's what Satan wanted. If he could get one generation of saints to become so egotistical and so self-centered, there wouldn't have been another one to follow it. Because God's purpose and design was that the oil should flow down over Aaron's beard, down over his garments to the very feet. There was to be no interruption. There would not be a second pouring out. They'd all have to be partakers of the original pouring out of that Holy Spirit. And so, dear friends, it behooves us so to live that others who may follow us may be inspired to life. I like a little illustration that this great Scotch actor, I've forgotten his name. Well, he used to say, I used to like to see the lamplighter come down the street. I don't know whether many of you folks remember the lamplighter. In the old days in New York City here, we had gas lamps. And, of course, the lamplighter had a pole with a little light in the top of it. And in the evening, he'd come along and he'd stick that pole into the light, turn on the gadget up there and light the lamp. And then he'd go on to the next one. He said, time came when I couldn't see the lamplighter, but I could see the light that he left behind. That's the thing, dear friends. The light that we leave behind. Oh, of course, we'll be missed. But the light should go on. Though dead, they yet speak. And so, he wasn't successful in this. So he went beyond that. He says, now, what is the trouble? How is it that they're still on the increase? And the midwife says, well, you know, it's different with the Hebrew women than it is with the Egyptian women. And how true that is, dear friend. I mean, spiritually speaking. You know who the Egyptians are, don't you? They're the world. Do you know who the Hebrews are? You and I. You're more active. They're out in the fields, out in the sunshine. You see? The Egyptians, they take it easy. Under the shade of the roof, the Israelites were out imbibing vitamin D and all the other sunshine that came from God in the fresh air. And they worked and they labored, which made them so much more lively. And with that life, they were able, of course, to begin so speedily that by the time the midwives got there, they weren't needed. So is it with the spiritual Israel of God? It's just exactly that way. They're not like the women of Egypt. The women, the church of Israel, the church of God, is not like that. It lives out in the open sunshine of God's glory and beauty. It labors. It works to make its calling and election sure. And so it is rich in its fruitage. The fruitage of the Spirit. So you see, dear friends, there was probably a lot of truth in the answer that Shiphrah and Puah gave unto Pharaoh. So he says, all right, that didn't work. I'll try something else. I demand that every one of you, and of course it referred to the fathers and mothers, when a male child is born, you shall kill it. Take it upon yourselves to do that. That's my command. That's my decree. And Pharaoh charged all the people, saying, every son that is born, ye shall cast into the river, and every daughter ye shall save alive. Now, dear friends, you see, it's getting down there in Egypt. So hot. 7 times hotter than it's ever been before. But I'll tell you who's going to be burned. The people who put on the heat. Pharaoh and his host. The same as when the 3 Hebrew children were cast into the fiery furnace. There's always a force there. And so Moses in due time was able to take his place with the children of God and suffer the afflictions Christ, rather than to enjoy the pleasures of Egypt for a moment. Well, at any rate, dear friends, there was a man in Israel, a Levite, and there was a woman, a Levite too. They were very closely related, a thing which was forbidden in after years. But one of them was Amram, which means exalted people. and a woman was Jochebed, which means Jehovah is glorious. And this all reflects back, you see. If his name was Amram and her name was Jochebed, they certainly didn't name themselves. It indicates that their parents before them must have been believers in the great promises of God. And thus you see the overruling providences which are there before you and I come upon the scene. Your mother may have been instrumental in teaching you some of the truth. She may not even have been aware of it. You may have been a member of a nominal church, but you learned Bible history. It stood you good, didn't it? That was a part of the overruling providence. Where else could you have gotten it? Certainly not in the world. And so, dear friend, sometimes, you know, it takes ravens, unclean birds, to feed Elijah. And if God says it's clean, who are we to say it is unclean? And thus we find then that this man and this woman, Amram and Jochebed, they already had two children. The oldest was Miriam, probably 12 or 15 years old. They also had a son. He was about 3 years old at this time. The daughter's name was Miriam. And you know, dear friends, Miriam is the first Mary in the Bible. Miriam is merely the Hebrew for Mary. Isn't that a sweet name? And her brother's name was Aaron. That's very close to Amram. And it's not too far a stretch from Abram and Abraham. So you see how the children were named, all was in honor of the God of the covenant, the God of Israel. That's how they were named. So about this time, the heat became so great down there. Of course, Miriam was a girl, so she wouldn't have been bothered anyway. Aaron had been born, but he was just far enough outside of the furnace to escape. And now came a little child, a little boy. The mother saw that he was a goodly child. And dear friends, it says he wasn't afraid of the king's commandment. In fact, it says they weren't afraid of the king's commandment. Well, dear friends, if Satan is the king, don't you be afraid of his commandments either. You have a perfect right to violate the law and the decrees of the king, if that king is Satan. And so here, of course, was a violation of the king's commands. She says, no, I'm not going to kill him. She busied herself. Why? Merely a maternal instinct. There were other mothers in Israel that had babes too. But here was one, she was a little different. And so she built a little basket of bulrushes. A little basket and placed it among the bulrushes, the reeds that grew in the Nile. The mother, of course, probably had been observing. The little cottage wasn't too far away, the little hut or whatever it was. It was on the banks of the Nile where she could see the daughter of Pharaoh come down there to take her daily, perhaps a religious bath. And she knew the heart of a woman, because she was a woman of faith. And she knew just exactly what to do, where to do it, when to do it, and how to do it. But it wasn't merely the maternal instinct, dear friends, because God was raising up a deliverer for his people. The Nile represents the waters of death, which might have swallowed up the great deliverer before he could even have undertaken the liberation of the children of Israel. It was no different in the reign of Herod, you remember. Satan recognized that here was the great deliverer. Here was the day's man. Here was the kinsman. the Redeemer concerning whom Job of old spoke, as he could kill him off as a child. That would end that. And seeing that he didn't succeed then, Jesus was out in the little boat there one evening, you remember. The storm came up on the water. He was fast asleep. And the disciples became very much worried. Satan thought he might play his cards then, but he didn't succeed. The result was that in every instance, God made the next move one which placated the adversary. Now notice what happened. And when she could no longer hide him, she took for him an ark of bulrushes and daubed it with slime and with pitch and put the child therein, and she laid it in the flags by the river's brink. And his sister stood afar off to wit what would be done to him. And the daughter of Pharaoh came down to wash herself at the river. And her maidens walked along the river side. And when she saw the ark among the flags, she sent her maid to fetch it. And when she had opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the babe wept. This is psychology in reverse. It's generally the woman who sheds tears to affect the man. Here, the man sheds the tears to reach the woman's heart. Now, tell her there's nothing more pitiful than to see a man in tears. Well, at any rate, this was mere babe. But nevertheless, we see how God worked to pull on the heartstrings of the daughter of Pharaoh, the very one who would have exterminated them in his very home. And isn't it strange that the great Redeemer is cared for right in the midst of this Egypt till we're old enough. Till we're old enough. You understand? And so he goes on to say here, and when she had opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the babe wept. And she had compassion on him, and said, this is one of the Hebrew's children. Then said his sister to Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go and call to thee a nurse of the Hebrew woman, that she may nurse the child for thee? Friends, I don't think that Pharaoh's daughter was at all deceived by the loot. I think she understood when she saw that child there. And when the child suggested, shall I get a Hebrew woman to nurse it for you? And she brought that pale face of Miriam before her. And when Miriam clasped the little thing to her breast, I don't think that the daughter of Pharaoh was deceived. I think she knew that it was the mother that was caring for her own child. And who would have given the child more tender care than his own mother? You see the way God works in a mysterious way, his wonders to perform. And so, of course, Miriam's there. She comes running along down the side of the bank, probably in her childlike innocence. Speaks a little too well. Perhaps she'd rehearsed it, who knows? But at any rate, we do know this, that in the overruling providences of God, Moses was taken back to his own mother, there to be nursed, to be fed, to be indoctrinated, and if you will have it, inoculated. This inoculation was against the poisons and the viruses that he might, of course, pick up in Egypt. You understand? It was sort of a vaccination that he got. And his own mother, in the tenderness of her heart, she administered cynically. Well, at any rate, dear friends, Pharaoh's daughter gave him the name of Mushe, which means drawn out. But the divine providence changed the name of Mushe to Moshe, which means the one drawn out shall be the one who draws out. And that's exactly what Moses was to do. He was drawn out of Egypt to draw the rest of Israel out of Egypt, wasn't he? Of course he was. You see the way God works it? Even in the name which the Egyptian princes gave him, there was the suggestion that divine providence now had ordained. And you know, dear friends, when Moses became of age, he knew right well that he was to be the deliverer of his people. But you won't read that in Genesis nor Exodus. You've got to come to the New Testament for that. Why? Because Moses was meek. Because he was lowly. He wouldn't speak to himself. You see? That's the character that God would use to develop for the deliverance of his people. And so it says, and Pharaoh's daughter said unto her, take this child away and nurse it for me, and I will give thee thy wages. And the woman took the child and nursed it. She didn't need any wages for it. But she took the wages for it. And so, of course, while she did not need it, so that her heart would be moved to take care of it, money will never do that. If there isn't love in the heart, there's nothing to move it. My son, give me your head. No, no. My son, give me thine heart. I've got the heart, got everything. And so, of course, she didn't need this to move her heart. But she accepted the wage. And the woman took the child and nursed it. And the child grew, and she brought him unto Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she called his name Moses. And she said, because I drew him out of the water. And notice, Moses was the son of two mothers. You know, dear friends, not as of a mother, but Jesus was the Son of God and the Son of man. And so you and I, we're in this world, aren't we? We're sons of God. But we're also sons of men, are we not? Of course we are. And so here again we have a parallel. It's not a deadly parallel. It's a lively one, a living parallel. And I think, dear friends, this is where we shall have to stop for today. And if, in the Lord's grace, the odd village continues, just so that you might read ahead, we'll commence with the 11th verse of the second chapter to this, in our next. May God bless.